In the year 2000, the Centers for Disease Control declared that measles had been eliminated from this country. Today we're seeing cases of measles breaking out in California and elsewhere too. Meanwhile, Kansas and Missouri rank in the bottom half of states for measles, mumps, and rubella vaccination rates. The debate around vaccination can quickly harden, with most people already firmly entrenched in their own viewpoints, and science decisive on the matter. So let's forget the debate. What is it about immunization that scares people? I'm Gina Kaufman, and that's the big question on today's Central Standard.
Fifteen years after U.S. health officials declared measles had been eliminated from our country, the virus is roaring back into
the recent outbreak of measles in California has reignited a national conversation about vaccines.
California allows parents to opt out of getting their
children vaccinated. Five new cases of measles were reported today. Five babies at a daycare center outside
Chicago. Telling parents who are afraid of vaccinating their children about the safety of vaccines might actually go in the other direction. It might be ineffective. They might be less likely to get their kids immunized.
I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on Central Standard, we'll go beyond the question of whether or not to vaccinate your children and try to understand more about the fears that have so many parents opting out, despite unwavering reassurances from the medical establishment. Vanessa Flood is a doula here in Kansas City, and she has a master's degree in biochemistry. Hi, Vanessa. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, Gina.
How does your background as a biochemist affect your perception of the immunization process and its safety?
My background's actually in microbiology.
Ooh, sorry.
That's okay. I figured I'd clarify. I think it gives me a little more comfort level with the conversation. I feel very comfortable around, well, not around, but with regards to vaccines and virology and immunology, because that was what I studied at KU. And so it definitely puts me at an advantage in terms of just a little relaxation.
Relaxation because you have information.
Because I have information and I trust how that information was gathered and maintained.
So do you generally, you encourage people to get their children vaccinated?
I am definitely pro-vaccination because I'm very comfortable there. Now, with that, I never just went blindly in with my kids. We still asked a ton of questions. We got package inserts. We still had that moment of, oh my gosh, what if mine is the one out of the however many that something horrible happens? But I believe in the greater good. And I know overall that it's better to be vaccinated than to end up with a hospitalization on a little person.
How can you explain the role of a doula, how you enter the birthing process?
So typically I am privately contacted by a couple, a mother who just wants a little support during her pregnancy and that childbirth experience. And then we get together, we set up a relationship, we check in and just answer any questions, be a source of information, a place to guide them, encourage conversations with their care providers, give them those questions, help them formulate those questions so that they're getting all the answers they need to make a good informed decision.
We have, I think, a lot of people this perception that there's like the natural approach to all of these things on one side and a medical approach on the other, and never the two shall meet. And you seem to kind of contradict that on a certain level. Why do you think that we're so polarized, this idea that something has to either be natural or medical?
It seems to me that you tend to want to relate into one group. I'm also a childbirth educator, and so for me, I have to walk that line and stay in the center of that line. I definitely can fall very crunchy, as they like to call it, and I definitely can fall very medical, but in the end, I like to come very neutral in that because I know that that's what's going to help our parents the most.
When expecting parents talk to you about vaccines, what are some of the most common things you hear, either as far as why people feel strongly about them, either way?
Either it's the greater good, they want to maintain herd immunity, they believe in the process, they believe in the science, it's what they did, it's what their parents did, is a big part of that. The hesitancy, and that's what we tend to refer to it as, is vaccine hesitancy, is the what if it's my little one? I hate to make them cry, I'm worried about side effects, I'm worried about the toxins, I'm worried about all the stuff I'm hearing on the internet, I'm worried about autism, I'm worried about that we're overwhelming these little people with vaccines. We're doing so many more vaccines than we did when they were little. And it's scary to be a new parent.
What have you been able to say to people that has been effective in making the process less scary?
We tend to send them back to their care providers, and hopefully they have a trusted care provider, and start engaging in those conversations with those who are very comfortable in this arena. And then we can address individual concerns like why the number of vaccines really isn't the accurate question. It's what are they being stimulated with? Or
can you explain that?
So each vaccine has a little individual parts and pieces to it, antigens. So these are bacterial pieces, viral pieces on an inactivated virus that cannot replicate disease. Historically, back in 1960, we were giving about 3,200 individual antigens for just a handful of diseases. Currently, we have that down to about 123 to 125, 26 individual antigens or bits and pieces that we used to stimulate a little one's immune system, or adults for that matter. And so even though we've almost doubled or tripled now the vaccine schedule, what we're actually injecting them with and stimulating with is so much less than we ever had in the past, which I think is very encouraging.
And so that's something that tends to make people feel a little bit of relief around those fears?
I think so. It doesn't feel like they're overwhelming. There was a study where they looked at the theoretical risk of overstimulating vaccines on an infant. And what they found was even if we gave 10,000 vaccines with 100 antigens in each, which we know that's total amount for their entire schedule at this point, we would still not even begin to overwhelm their immune system. If we gave all 11 vaccines on their early childhood schedule, we would use, in their theoretical evaluations, about 0.1% of their immune system.
So when people come to you and they're talking about things that they're afraid of, there are some specific things, and you've mentioned a few of those fears they name, like autism, or like that there's just too much, that it's going to overwhelm the children. Are there also more abstract things, either that people say out loud or that you perceived to be kind of underlying a lot of this?
Some of it, I think, is probably has to do with, well, if there was the study out about vaccines and MMR relating to autism, even though we know that's been withdrawn, we knew that there was falsified information. But the fact that that made it to a publication is really scary, because it begins to offer that doubt, like, well, what else is out there that's wrong? And, you know, we used to put babies to sleep on their stomachs, and now we put them on their backs, and that information has changed. So what if down the road we get to a place where information has changed and we did all this now? And it's scary when you're in charge of raising a little human being.
Yeah. Do parents who choose to vaccinate struggle with that decision as well? I mean, we tend to think of fear as something that keeps people from doing something, but are there shared fears?
I think sometimes there are shared fears. And the first one tends to be the hardest, I think, as you move through. And once you realize, oh, that went okay, we may be a little fussier, we may be sleepier, we may be crabby, we may have that swelling and redness. But each one after that tends, in reaction terms, tends to get a little bit less localized.
Are there fears that you hear people expressing that really make a lot of sense to you, and that you think that we as a society need to address in some manner?
I think the fear of, like for our measles, picking up that as epidemics, it's hard when people use the word epidemic and pandemic, even though we're talking about 100 cases or 300 cases, and why that's such a big deal, and no one has died, and we used to do this all the time. And it does get very polarized in those conversations, and it elicits a lot of anger for some reason, and anger just doesn't come across as very supportive. And so these conversations are shut down before they ever begin.
So this is something I've been thinking about a lot. I wonder if medical and scientific reassurances fall flat because the fears themselves aren't necessarily medical or scientific fears. Becoming a parent is just scary, as you've said, and a needle puncturing a child's skin and depositing a substance created in a lab is scary, just on a gut level.
It is. And And there's not a lot you can do for that fear. We can try to reassure, we can back that with science, but sometimes just to connect as a parent, you know, to say, I know when I had my little ones, I was terrified. And I hate to admit it, but I took pictures of all my kids before their vaccines when they were itty bitty because I thought, well, what if I'm the one? And I wanted to have most recent pictures. And it's really a morbid thought to go to as a parent. And very few will admit that, but you know that's what they're thinking because parents, we always go to worst case scenarios as parents. And so I think to address those deep, dark fears head on makes a world of difference when we're talking with parents.
I want to bring our other guest in on this. David Ropeek is the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. Good morning, David.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Well, what do you think about this issue of trying to use science and medicine to assuage fears that aren't medical or scientific in nature?
Well, you can use the information, but it's not the first thing to use. And Vanessa's been spot on with her comments. Fear, as you just suggested, is not a fact-based process. It's a feeling. In fact, the definition of risk in the dictionary is the probability of something bad happening. So you can calculate the probability, the odds of getting measles or a side effect from the vaccine. That's the chance. But bad is a feeling. Fear is a feeling. So the risk communication consulting that I and others do and teaching and so forth does exactly what Vanessa suggested in a number of ways. You need to respect people's fears. Respect. Not agree with their point of view, but respect the validity of their feelings. And treating them that way then allows you to afford them information that hopefully by treating them with respect, you'll have more trust and that information will carry more influence. And that does work out to be the case, except in those cases where, as Vanessa suggested, the views are so informed and the fears are so informed by deep, deep, deep values. Hey, government, stay out of my life, or I don't want anything unnatural in my kid. And those values are self-identity. And we identify with our friends and the people in our groups so that we agree with them, and Vanessa also said we belong to one group. We shape our views so that they agree with our friends in our groups, so that our friends say, oh, they agree with me. They're a good member of the group in good standing. When the Indians attack, they get to be inside the circle. I mean, it's an adaptive behavioral thing. So for those folks, unfortunately, even being treated with respect will make the conversation go better, but probably won't change their mind. But again, as Vanessa suggested, the largest number of people out there who are hesitant about vaccines are not out-and-out refusers. That's less than 1% of American children, actually. But they're picking and choosing which vaccines to do or delaying against the schedule, which also has health effects. And they are amenable to information from trusted sources like pediatricians or anybody who treats their feelings with respect.
So this idea of the delayed vaccination, it seems to me that that part of the idea there is this idea of a desire to compromise when two different options both seem risky, and that drive to create a third option where you would maybe get the best of both worlds. That seems to be what people are doing with this delayed vaccination schedule. Is it your sense that from a sort of probability and logic standpoint that there is something to that, or is it flawed in some way?
Well, it's flawed in the sense that estimations of probability are also a matter of subjective feeling rather than cold, hard fact. We don't do probability very well either. If I flip a coin 10 times and it comes up heads, you're just going to want to say the next time is more likely to be tails, but it's not so. If we see a lot of people in one neighborhood who all have cancer, we think, oh, there must be something in the neighborhood. But no, it's not so. We don't do probability very well either. What that tendency is to pick and choose and delay is born out of people's really super sensitive concern about their kids. And I have two. My wife and I talked about this too. This was many years ago now. We look for things to give us a sense of control. Let me pause there. Control. When we do something, it feels like we're taking control. And control is reassuring. Empowerment is reassuring. We do it in tons and tons and tons of ways. We get hands-free devices to drive and talk on our phone in the car. Still distracts our brain and it doesn't make us safer, but it makes us feel safer
because we're doing something. When we pick and choose the vaccines, it's an act of taking control, and that is reassuring. And it affords itself as an easy option because you can do that. It's not, you can't opt out. It's harder to opt out, although it should be even harder still. But so it's a matter of wanting control, I think.
Let's hear from our other guest, Vanessa Flood. Can you tell me more about when people do choose this, what seems like a viable third option, this delayed vaccination schedule? Can you explain the thought process there as you witness it in your conversations?
Right. And I agree with David. It definitely having some control in my line of work, childbirth, birth, parenting, there's not a lot of control there. So that alternative schedule seems like a great compromise. Like, yes, we're so excited parents are vaccinating their children. However, it is a really uncontrolled science experiment. We have absolutely no scientific data on any alternate schedules. There is no standardization of alternate schedules because everyone is pick and choosing what they're comfortable with. And it's hard to understand that the original schedule was set out to protect children at their most vulnerable times. So we know that mothers pass antibodies to their unborn children, and that passive immunity will work for 2 to 4 to 6 months, depending on what type of antibody. And so then we start vaccinating kids at 2 months, at 4 months, and to pick up that lag. But if we are delaying a vaccine that should have been done at 2, 4, and 6 months, or 2 months, 8 months, 12 months, whatever it is, and not doing it until we're three, at three, we'd be fine. Even if we got it, we might get really sick, but the likelihood of hospitalization, secondary infections, death is much less of a risk than it would have been there. And that's really where it gets tricky. And we start to lose some of that herd immunity on these alternate schedules. But for me, a vaccine-hesitant parent who actually will step into that, even if it's baby steps, is probably a parent who's going to get a little reassurance that, okay, this worked out all right. It's good in my kids. So I will probably vaccinate my next kids down the line. And maybe I'll start adhering more to the recommended schedule. Or maybe not. But regardless, we at least have a greater pocket of the community that's been immunized.
So there's a stepping stone there.
Yes. And it seems to be a nice bridge, which is why I think a lot of pediatricians are finally just submitting to it, because their alternative is to push these parents away. And then if they don't feel supported by their pediatricians and family practice physicians, then where do they go?
So is there something about the way we talk about parenting, or maybe the way we even talk about the world, that has heightened our fears of what's outside of us, what's out there in the world? Like, parents are afraid of letting their children walk to school, of the possibility of gunmen at school, of food in the grocery store. And there are reasons for those fears. And a vaccine could be seen as another thing, like a thing from the outside world, which presents danger.
Right. And the one thing that I could actually say no to, unfortunately, by saying no, I'm still making a decision to expose them to the rest of the illnesses from the outside world. But that seems a little bit more, well, we picked up something at the park, or we picked up something at school.
It just happened.
It just happened, even though it was a direct result of not making that decision to vaccinate. But it felt like it took it out of my control a little bit.
Do you think that the need to vaccinate can be taken as a statement that this human you created isn't born just ready to take on the world? You know what I mean? Can it be seen as a value judgment?
I think it can. I think it can. We definitely know that we have a responsibility to these little people, to keep them alive, to get breastfeeding going, to make sure things are going well. And it's a crazy good system. And you have to believe that when you work in childbirth and with parenting and those kind of things. So if it isn't a crazy good system, why do we need to do this? But Mother Nature's not always perfect.
Part of the issue of herd here is herd immunity, which is something that you've talked about a little bit already. That means that when the vast majority of the group is immunized, that protects everyone. So I wonder if that's just not a way we're used to thinking about parenthood. So much about parenting is about doing the very best thing for this one little person and not putting that little person at even infinitesimally small risk for the sake of random unknown people.
Right. And it's a hard concept to understand for some reason. And we know that disease is prevalent with or without herd immunity. We know that we've had pockets of outbreaks with 100% vaccinated kids in different schools and churches and those kind of things. But we also know that vaccines aren't 100%. We know that they're going to wane through age. We know that boosters are credible, which is why we constantly strive to keep that information up to date and try to change our guidelines as we move through so that safety is of utmost concern.
Central Standard has to take a short break. When we come back, we want to hear from you, especially if you're someone who's changed your mind or feels uncertain about vaccines. When you're not entrenched in a viewpoint, what is it that's scary? 816-235-2888. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today, we're talking about the increasing fears around vaccination, and now the corresponding fear of serious diseases like measles. We've been hearing so far from doula Vanessa Flood, who works with parents here in Kansas City. Hi again, Vanessa.
Hello, Gina.
And we've also been talking with David Ropeek. He's the author of the book, How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. And we'll be right back to him shortly. So, Vanessa, I want to get back to you. Tell me about what the conversations about this tend to be like for you. Do conversations about vaccination tend to be weighing of pros and cons, or is there a different way that those conversations play out?
It depends on each parent and their relationship and their question and where their concern lies. For us, as doulas, we walk them through the process. So their first vaccination experience is in hospital. We recommend doing the hepatitis B vaccination by we, the CDC, and the World Health Organization in the hospital. They do that vaccine in the hospital not so much to protect this little one from sexually transmitted diseases and bloodborne pathogens, all these things that they probably will not be exposed to anytime soon in their little life. But we do it as the greater good. So other countries have piloted vaccination programs, and by doing hepatitis B series beginning at birth, they have dropped their overall adult rates of hepatitis B tremendously, substantially, over 50%. And we know a lot of high-risk families, they will never go back and do well-child checks until
what
a baby.
What does high-risk mean?
These are families who maybe don't have health insurance. These are families who maybe are living in poverty conditions. They don't have vehicles. They're struggling with their day-to-day needs. They don't have access to good
healthcare. But we're hearing so much about that the communities where vaccines are decreasing in incidence are actually often well-to-do and well-educated communities.
And that's a lot of times where the big concern is coming, because we rely on these, I hesitate to say more affluent communities or better educated communities, because these historically have been the communities that hold that herd immunity for families. So we do a lot in our daily world to protect those most at risk with families. On the flip side of that, a lot of more impoverished families, they actually have better access to immunizations, and they tend to adhere to those rules a little bit easier. They're paid for by the state. They're paid for with any of their medical cards and those kind of things. So they tend to be more proactive in terms of vaccinations.
Is part of what we're talking about here mistrust of the very medical communities and scientific communities presenting data in support of vaccination? If you're suspicious of doctors, CDC reports aren't going to comfort you.
Absolutely not. And when people are looking for good evidence-based research sites and good sound information, these are where we should be sending people, is to the CDC site and the sites maintained by the CDC, because they actually do have the most current information. And when we start to go off the beaten path, that's when our studies get a little shaky and less reliable.
David, I want to get you in on this. What is your, you know, who can provide reliable information when the sources who would normally be providing it are not seen as trustworthy? How do we evaluate risk depending on? Oh, excuse me. Well, I'll ask that to you, Vanessa. How do you evaluate risk when you don't know who to trust?
And that's where it gets really scary. I feel very confident in my decisions to trust the CDC, and I trust that these studies are done correctly. And I trust that the general population who do these studies really do have a vested interest in children. I don't believe that anyone is out to target children and parents and make their lives horrible. And I just can't believe that working in a lab day to day, you could do that under good conscience.
We have a caller who came to us and wanted to know, wasn't able to stay on the line, but wanted to know about Congress creating a resource called the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. In his mind, the very existence of such an organization and such a repository of information suggests uncertainty about the safety of vaccines. Is that part of what you hear about from people, and how can you allay that fear?
That typically is not one of our greater concerns that I hear in my role of just supporting new parents in classes, but it is a really unsettling feeling to know that this organization exists. It was originally set up as a way to provide better safety data. If we can have a clearinghouse where not only physicians have to report any adverse effects, but the general population can report adverse effects. I reported my little one after her varicella vaccine because we got the chickenpox from the vaccine, and that was noted as an adverse effect, and I wanted that reported. And the follow-up care I received and the many, many, many phone calls from people following up, making sure she was okay, finding out how many pox it was, documenting with her physician, I actually found really reassuring that they wanted this information. And even though claims have been made and claims are filed out and people are receiving compensation for injuries, it is not a direct cause of vaccines. If there was enough likelihood that it may have been the vaccine, more often than not, compensation will occur because we want to try and support new families and we don't want them to have any extra hardships with any medical costs that could possibly be accelerated or associated with these vaccinations. And it's a way to get more data to improve the safety of vaccines.
So it's almost a forum for communication, it sounds like.
It is. And it was, I think, originally meant to provide a reassurance that we're not just going to make you vaccinate your kids and try to force that issue, that we really do acknowledge that there are never any absolutes.
David Ropeek, author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. What are your thoughts about that, about who we trust with information and how we interpret information?
Oh, goodness. So the perception of anything, including this phone call or this conversation by your listeners and all our participation, is a process that goes through a bunch of instincts and filters and mental shortcuts before we come up with how we feel about it. And that's particularly true of risk. And that's particularly true of risk for our kids. Super sensitive emotional thing, the perception of anything, but particularly risk in our kids. So the things that matter for the effectiveness of communication are less the information itself and more the respect for feelings by doing it in a way that's trusted, having the local pediatrician do it, by validating people's feelings initially, by addressing their concerns through the emotional lenses that are relevant to them. So, for example, a person who doesn't want anything unnatural in their body, that needs to be specifically recognized and addressed, as Vanessa's been doing very well with the information. But that's the first part to address. Engage the conversation on an emotional level because that's how we perceive most things first. That develops trust, which increases influence. And to the extent that the person is amenable to any information and really looking for some, that'll have more effect.
So would you say that the decision about whether to vaccinate your kids is essentially weighing two different kinds of risk, one against the other?
Well, sure. And well, it's more than that, but it's the risk of the disease versus the risk of the vaccine, if you want to get really simplistic about it. And vaccines, it's been said by a lot of people, are a victim of their own success. When they work, the diseases go away, and we forget that risk. And so the small risk of small side effects for most vaccines starts to look larger by comparison. In fact, this is historic. We know how this has happened and is likely to play out in the future. Ever since Edward Jenner smeared a little cowpox on 9-year-old James Phipps, it freaked people out, and there was an anti-vaccine movement against smallpox. But boy, as soon as there's a smallpox outbreak, we're so much more afraid of that. And look at what America did in the early 1900s when there was a smallpox outbreak. The federal government empowered vaccine squads to go around and with police in New York and Boston and in the South, held people down and forced them to be vaccinated. Did it at handcuff, gunpoint, quarantine blacks in the South. So the fear of the disease versus the fear of the vaccine is a seesaw, and an understandable seesaw. That comes and goes as the vaccines succeed and the diseases disappear. And that's probably what's going to happen here. It's already happening, by the way, in California, where a lot of parents, I read at least in the paper, that are still afraid of vaccines, say, but now I'm more afraid of measles. Give my kid the shot.
So, yeah, it's these two relative risks. And then what about this idea of people becoming entrenched in positions? I wonder if part of it, it's like, whether a decision like this just tends to go that way. It would be hard to live with uncertainty about whether you'd done the right thing for your child. So do people banish uncertainty for the sake of peace of mind? Is that part of being entrenched in the position?
Well, the evidence, and so far it's apocryphal, it's pretty strong apocryphal, but not really heavily researched, is that there are a set of values that are informing some of the more adamant people. That's the more adamant, right? There are all kinds of vaccine hesitancy, and most of them are just decent parents trying to do the right thing for the kid and not compelled by deep underlying values of individualism and libertarian and mistrust of pharma and not wanting natural things. But the people who do come from those value points of view see themselves as people who live that way. That's part of their self-identity, is what I was suggesting earlier. We have strong values and kind of so-so values. And the more we identify ourselves as a kind of person with certain kinds of values, and that we are a member of a tribe that holds those values, so we're a member in good standing in the tribe, which helps keep us social animals safe, then the more strongly bits and pieces of information that come in are going to appeal to and fit into those values. So that's one branch of vaccine hesitancy. It's more the refusal side. And it's for people whose self-identity is really strongly associated with being all natural or all libertarian or whatever.
You know,
but again, that's a small slice.
I want to jump in about this tribe issue, because I do think it would be really hard to be part of a group of friends that all see something as evil and to not be susceptible to those fears, especially like...
Super hard.
Yeah. So how do you work with that? I mean, what do you say to a person who, there's a sense I think people have of safety in numbers. Like if everyone around you does something, it must be right or it must be okay.
Well, it's not just the numbers. Yes, there is the social effect that what you do, what people around you are doing. And by the way, that's true of most vaccination programs. And why, by the way, most general vaccines for kids are above herd immunity in most places. There are variations on the various vaccines and in various locations. But most people do what people around them are doing, and they just kind of do that. But the people who have really strong values do associate their sense of safety with being seen as a member in good standing in the tribe. That's why you've seen in some liberal communities people having measles parties and chickenpox parties.
What do you mean? What?
They're so devoutly against anything human-made going into their kids' bodies that they get – if there's a kid sick, they get them all together to infect their kids so that they can be exposed to the natural disease as though that's better. Okay, I'll make my kid immune by giving him measles or chickenpox. Oh, yeah, this has absolutely happened. That's because the tribal thing matters so much to them. Now, in that case, we have to move on. And I have an op-ed coming out in the Los Angeles Times tomorrow that says this. For the people whose choices are so compelled by these deep values that they are basically cognitively impervious to communication, and we're having a conversation, by the way, about this that's 15 years old, and we're still having it because some people are cognitively impervious to information. Society has the right, well established, under a variety of laws, to say that an individual choice that puts the greater community at risk needs to be constrained We can do that in a number of ways. Opting out is one thing that parents can do for personal belief or religious reasons. But let's make that harder. Let's give them the choice. I don't want to go all Rand Paul and Chris Christie on you, but yeah, in a democracy, yeah, let's give people choice. Let's not make them, let's make it more than just signing off on a form. So if you have a personal belief exemption, you need to bring in an essay that you've written that explains what your personal beliefs are with evidence that suggests here's how I'm living my life that's consistent with that.
Hey, David, I want to get back. We will get back to this issue of leadership and policy, but I want to get back to how the group mentality and group safety and belonging play into decisions about risk and safety. And I'd like to turn to Vanessa about this. Vanessa, how do people's social groups affect what they do and don't feel comfortable with?
And David's absolutely right. You know, those that kind of my friends are doing it. This is kind of my pocket. I really connect with these women as mothers. We do our play groups together. We share information on how we parent. We're very similar in those philosophies. And I think ways that we bring in an alternate conversation to these little groups, and just as much as I only vaccinate and, oh my gosh, these parents who don't vaccinate and herd immunity, even, you know, every group has a group. But it's the personal stories that should give us pause, where if I have a really strong vaccination group, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe these parents aren't doing herd immunity. But then you have a story of a mother who comes in and she talks compellingly about how her little one all of a sudden regressed tremendously in maybe autisms or on the spectrum disorder and has really struggled in what their family deals with. And if she truly believes that that's part of that vaccine, we know every baby and body responds differently to certain things. And if I was already in maybe a compromised state to begin with, maybe I do have more adverse effects. I'm not going to deny her reality because that's her reality and that's what she's living with. And so to come in and just say, well, you have to vaccinate, we know that not everyone has to vaccinate, which is why those who are comfortable need to be vaccinating so that we can give some freedom to these parents who are a little more hesitant, who want a baby step in, who maybe need to delay out, they're immunocompromised, their little ones can't have vaccines, and give them a voice too without being so polarized. I think it's the personal stories that can really help shape some different values and opinions a little bit more and add more perspective to the conversation. Babies who get really sick and end up in the NICU, end up being hospitalized at Children's Mercy for 3-4 weeks and IV antibiotics and spinal taps and all of that because they came down in meningitis or group strep B bacteria. It's good for them to be able to share their stories, and it might take pause and others to realize, oh, right, there is a flip side to this discussion.
You mentioned specifically with autism and that a parent might start questioning a relationship of a vaccine. There's so much that's unknown about autism and particularly the causes. I wonder what how the unknown plays into issues of risk and our perceptions of risk. David?
Well, uncertainty, you've touched on it a couple of times. Instinctively, you're spot on. So when we don't know what we need to know to protect ourselves, you feel like you're powerless. That feeling of lack of control makes you desperate to know. And so in the mid-1990s, 12 parents of autistic kids went to Andrew Wakefield and said, would you test my kid to see whether the vaccines might have caused autism? And his paper in The Lancet, now withdrawn for a variety of reasons, basically, if you read the paper, it's amazing. It says, no, there's no connection. But those parents were hungry for an answer. That's the point. And Wakefield was promoting a single vaccine at the time, and there were some corruptions. So at his news conference, he said, well, let's give these vaccines one at a time. And the press took off with that. And parents, desperate for an answer for this tragic condition that their kids have, because if you know what caused it, you might be able to cure it or treat it, wanting certainty, wanting empowerment, jump on the suggestion that here might be an answer. Uncertainty is a huge part of what makes things scarier. And so the answer, when you think it might be there, reassures against that fear.
Let's hear a personal story, because we were just hearing that those are the things that really bring this to life. Let's talk to Kevin in Midtown. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, I put off getting my tetanus shot because I don't want the extra thermosol, the extra mercury in my system. You know, I'm a 40-year-old guy, and I'm trying to stay as with it as I can. And I just don't see the reason I should do that, especially if I can get the the vaccine afterwards, if I was to get lockjaw, I could go in and it would apply retroactively.
So
is there a mercury-free vaccine where I could just get it and not worry about it?
So this sounds like is a medical question, but Kevin, I want to talk to you for a second about the fear of mercury. Like, can you talk to us a little bit about how, I don't know, how you weigh that fear against, in your case, tetanus?
Well, you know, I think I enjoy my life mostly because I can understand it and kind of navigate this world, and I don't want to be less awake, and that's one thing I see mercury doing. I mean, it's a neurotoxin, and I really don't want more of it in my system. I also get a gold fillings instead of mercury fillings, or porcelain if I could afford it. Porcelain actually costs more. These are things I do just so long term, when I'm 80, I'll still be sharp as a tack, I hope.
So, yeah.
Hey, Kev, let me interject. Here's an easy one for you. The Tamiflu preservative that still is in some adult vaccines, and that's a whole area that we haven't talked about, which is a huge area. It's still in flu vaccine, is not the kind of mercury that does harm. There are different kinds of mercury. It's not all the same. And it's not the kind of mercury that has been found to do harm. So you can rest assured on that one, basically, on the science. There's ethyl and methyl and all kinds of mercury. I don't have to get into the science. But it's not the kind that has been tested that is a neurotoxin. It's just not that kind. So rest easy on that one.
So the getting of information, it seems like, is so crucial on this. And how do you, you know, David, you are someone who studies risk, not someone who studies mercury. How are you getting this kind of information?
Well, so for example, I wrote an earlier book which has a chapter about like the risk of mercury, and I had to dive deep down into the weeds of facts that I never did as a television reporter covering environmental stuff and learn about this mercury issue. And that's when I first discovered that there are organic and inorganic and various types of mercury, and only one particular kind becomes biologically active in a way that creates neurotoxicity. By the way, the neurotoxicity of that kind of mercury is actually, at the doses that we get it, like in vaccines and fish and stuff like that, so weak that kids who are exposed at high levels during their fetal development have 0.25 IQ point decrement. So it's a pretty weak one, even when it's active. But anyway, my point being this, most people don't dig deep down in the weeds. I was a reporter. I should have. I didn't. And so we go with the pieces of information we've heard, like Kevin's heard about mercury. That makes complete sense. Kevin probably has not done the deep weeds research on mercury. And we make these judgments very quickly based on how it feels and what our friends have said. And vaccines is a good example.
David and Vanessa, let's pick this right up after the break. I'm Gina Kaufman in Central Standard. We'll be right back. Don't go away. I'm Gina Kaufman. Welcome back. We're here talking about vaccines today from the standpoint of why people are afraid of them. Our guests are Vanessa Flood, she's a doula, and David Ropeek. He's the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. And right before we went to break, David was talking about very, very minor risks associated with a substance in some vaccines, like tiny risk of tiny percentage, tiny outcome. But I wonder how we weigh tiny risk even when it comes to children. David?
Well, tiny is risk is a feeling. What may be tiny statistically isn't tiny if it's your kid, as Vanessa I'm sure knows. Right? So 1 in 1 million is too high if the one could be your kid. We don't run around as adaptive creatures trying to help the others survive as much as ourselves. So we need to be really careful with that tiny business. What I was talking about with Kevin was simply that kind of mercury isn't a risk at all. It's not just not the bioactive kind at all. But tiny and probability and uncertainty and control, these are all trust. These are all emotional factors, instincts that we all share, it looks like. This is the research that I've talked about in my book, that are filters that make things feel more or less scary. And one of the hugest filters of all is the next generation. We as a species need to keep going. So that means protecting our kids, and super, super sensitive to any number, no matter how small it is,
when it does involve our kids. And that makes us more emotionally amenable to alarming information that triggers something that the psychologists call loss aversion, where we overweight the downside of something. The more afraid of it we are, the more imminent and the more awful it is. We overweight, oh my God, I could die, I could lose. And the one in a million jumps to the top of the list.
Vanessa, what do you feel about this? I mean, how do you tell someone that a concern is tiny when people are scared for deep evolutionary reasons having to do with a parent's hardwired impulse to shield a child from harm?
I don't think I've ever told a parent, but it's so tiny, go ahead and do it. Because then I'm just dismissing them and telling them to do it.
There you go.
I know that the chances of my children being kidnapped walking to small school are infinitesimally small. But as a parent, have I done it? No, I walk them to school every day. I'm now letting my high schooler walk, which is almost embarrassing. So a lot of people can look at me personally and say, you keep a pretty tight rein on your kids. And even I'm affected by this. I only feel comfortable in the vaccine world in understanding those risks because that was my major. That was what I specialized in. So in good conscience, I just can't come in and kind of do that risk. But I can look at the more overwhelming incidences, like with the measles outbreak. We know that 6 out of 100 roughly will get a secondary pneumonia to that. Will most kids recover? Absolutely. Will some with secondary issues of asthma and those kind of things maybe require hospitalization or worse? Absolutely. We know encephalitis is about 1 in 1,000, that inflammation of the brain with measles. We know that encephalitis as a result of the vaccine is 1 in 1 million. There's that 1 in 1 million we always throw around. And then death from measles is 2 in 1,000.
Gina, if may I? Or
yes, please.
One of the things that helps enrich communication with folks in situations like this is it's not just the numeric odds of something happening, but it's the consequences. So one of the things that has been effective for a number of parents trying to weigh this is what happens to the kid if you get a side effect from the vaccines, and what is the nature of what the kid suffers if they get the disease. So in general, and Vanessa would know this better than I, the nature of the side effects of vaccines are a little rash, a little bit of a fever, or, you know, the shot, it's sore, and the nature of the measles or the mumps or the diphtheria or the whooping cough, oh my God, are a lot more suffering. So when I talk to my friends about this, it's kind of like weighing the suffering, not the odds. And that is an emotional language that has some resonance that helps.
Are there some kinds of risks that are just scarier than others, even if they're not more imminently dangerous?
Oh, my God. And the problem is, and this is a phenomenon, pardon me for butting in again. Vanessa.
No, go ahead.
The problem here is that we forget that we're too afraid of some things, but at the same time, not afraid enough of others. And that's what's going on with the measles thing that we're talking about. But Ebola versus the flu is the same thing, or there are tons of them. There's something that I call the risk perception gap, which is when, for all these emotional reasons that I've written about, and we're talking about a few, you worry more than the evidence says you need to, or less, and do dumb stuff. And there are tons of them. And let me talk about one specifically because it's relevant to this conversation. We've focused so far, and that's what's in the news at the moment, on measles. But 40% of Americans, 45% of Americans get their flu shot. And the flu can kill in a bad season up to 39,000 people in the same range of people who are vulnerable to the spread of measles and mumps, people with no or weakened immune systems. Influenza doesn't scare people because they say, oh, I can get over that. Or they say, I'm afraid of the shot because, like Kevin said, you know, it's got Tamiflu in it. And we're not as afraid as we ought to be about some risks like the flu, and that can be bad for us too.
You know, I want to chime in because when we talk about there being emotional reasons for a decision, I think people could hear that as dismissive as a way of saying that's not a compelling reason.
That's a very good point. And as I said earlier, and I'll say again, and thank you for bringing it up, emotions are totally valid. They're not irrational. I hate the people who say, oh, you're being dumb. Look at the facts. That's why I try not to use the numbers like Vanessa doesn't. I validate their feelings. I validate my wife's and yours and everybody's. Feelings are valid. They're real. They're all we have to go on, as a matter of fact. They may lead to views that don't agree with the facts. That's disagreeing about the information. But the beginning of the conversation is to absolutely respect Kevin's concern about Tamarisol and a mother's concern about her infant and anyone's, to validate the honesty of the feelings, and then have a conversation about whether that may or may not be informing a healthy choice for you.
Vanessa, how do you do that? That sounds like a tall order, what our other guest just said.
I think we just have to listen, you know, and we bring up that conversation. You know, we've got hepatitis B coming, and how do you feel about that? Are you worried? Do you have concerns? And just listen. I think listening is probably the best idea we could all do.
So walk people through the concerns.
Right. Absolutely.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's show. Vanessa Flood, thank you so much for being with us and sharing your insights. Have a great rest of your day.
Thank you, Gina. Pleasure.
And David Ropeek, it's been a real pleasure talking with you, too. Thank you.
Thanks for the chance to contribute.
David is the author of How Risky Is It Really? Why Our Fears Don't Always Match the Facts. You can listen back to this conversation at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Tomorrow, we'll be hearing from a researcher in our area who is studying orbital trash in space. In other words, space junk. That and more tomorrow at 10. Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. I'm Gina Kaufman. That's it for today's show. Stick around for Up to Date, coming right up next.